felt edged out of the frame. As she stood there on the roof, staring at the image, Kara felt like she was practically flying, headed toward the Desuco Quadrant, past Tanopa and Nidaz, and finally the tiny dwarf planet called Ralier. She watched as the hollow zeroed in, past the atmosphere, farther, farther, until she could see topography and finally an aerial view of a city. Then the words unfurled across the skyline. "The past is gone, but the future you seek is here. 678.900.05. "Those coordinates are on Ralier." Pavel emitted a red pointer beam and circled a section on the northern hemisphere of the dwarf planet. 12th celestial body from the sun. "I don't comprehend how you can seek your future there."
"It's not literal," Kara said. If the message was only for her, then it was referring to her past. Her past as Jocelyn Ta'an, the one that Lydia had taken away. It had to be. Which meant, I think, this is talking about the Overrider.
"You and Alyosha had always discussed the possibility of it being on Rayta, because that's what Lydia told us." Kara leaned forward and pivoted the cylinder on the floor so the coordinates grew a little bigger, a little brighter.
"But what if someone moved it?
Or what if Lydia had lied?" "Are you suggesting we go to Ralier?" Pavel asked. 2/3 of the planet is covered in black ice, with prairies and valleys in the southmost region. But it also has the most crime of any habitable body in the system. It's not safe."
But when was the last time Kara felt safe anyway?
The beach. The memory came to her smoothly, quietly, like it always did. She and Lydia had moved around a lot, but for a while they lived in Luris, a town in the north of Kalu, cold and gray, by dark waters on a rocky shore, where Kara would watch crabs crawl in and out of layers of wet rock. A choppy ocean, and a forest at her back. It was her favorite place in the world.
"You have to be careful," Lydia had told her one day.
Kara remembered how her long hair whipped in the wind, stinging her face and getting in her mouth. But she liked the bite of the air and refused to put on a jacket. She'd just gotten over a bad headache, and it felt like she'd woken up from a deep sleep. Now, Kara realized, it really had been a kind of awakening, because that day on the beach had been her first day as Kara. That memory wasn't just any memory. It was Kara's first memory, even though she'd been about 12 years old.
"I might not always be around to take care of you," Lydia had tried to explain then.
At the time, Kara had listened without really understanding. But the context of it now felt wrong. She saw the lie for everything it was. Lydia's idea of taking care of her had been to use the Overrider on her, to erase all memory of being Jocelyn Ta'an. Then Lydia had grabbed her hands so tightly that Kara had dropped all the smooth rocks she'd been collecting.
"If something happens to me," Lydia had said that cold day on the beach, "I need you to think through all your options, to stay safe."
But where would playing it safe get her now? There was a dangerous weapon out there, one that could steal memories, mine them. It could erase entire histories and make new ones. It could reinvent the world, for the worse.
"Nothing is safe anymore," Kara said to Pavel.
"Does this mean we're going to Ralier, then?" Kara nodded. "As soon as we break out Ali from wherever they've got him." It turned out there was a single internment camp on Nau Fruma, hastily set up just a few hundred meters from the old marketplace. Ali had to be there,
along with all the other Raetons and Fontizians the Uniforce had rounded up. Kara and Pavel spent the next 24 hours monitoring the camp from a new lookout point, watching security guards rotate shifts. They figured out a time, a precise fraction of a moment, Kara could slip in unnoticed and break Allie out. Rhiannon's televised coronation would provide the perfect distraction. Meanwhile, Kara managed to pocket tools from the vendor stalls in the central square and secured a prison guard uniform off the black market that cost all the credits she could scramble together. When she got back to their new lookout spot, Pavel was furiously beeping and blinking as he rolled toward her. "I have something," he said, projecting a hollow of a line graph. "What am I looking at?" Kara said, squinting at the screen. When the last round of Overrider research turned up nothing, Alyosha directed me to continue combing the hollow forums. He didn't tell me that. Her heart beat faster. Why hadn't she and Allie talked about it together? He requested we keep it private so as not to elevate your hopes if attempts were futile. However, I pieced together some information on a hunch. Kara very much doubted Pavel had hunches, so much as algorithms, but sure. Well? He blinked his blue eyelights. I found a mention of a testing facility on Rheta, and I cross-referenced it with the G1K summit dates prior to Deok Zophim's death, he said. Deok was the scientist Lydia told them about, the one who'd pioneered the Overrider tech and ended up suspiciously dead immediately after. And finally, the frequency of times Emperor Ta'an mentioned new technology in his speeches. The Emperor? Kara wondered. It wasn't a variable she would have thought to include. And I found this. It was formatted like an official memo, written in a language she didn't recognize. It shared some qualities with the collusion characters, but the lines were simpler. When Pavel activated the translation screen, the letters blurred apart and rearranged themselves in modern collusion. New developments in the biotech device. Deletion or overwriting of the cube may result in memory loss. Work suggests that new technology for targeted memory deletion is not far off. Kara read along quickly, not sure what she was reading, but with the sensation she was tumbling down a slope, faster and faster toward an inevitable crash that would hurt. But at least the falling would end. Furthermore, targeted memory deletion on a mass scale is achievable if the cube using public were uniformly updated with the latest technology so that specific molecular mechanisms can be identified and wiped. Kara sucked in a breath. She knew of the Overrider's capabilities because it had been used on her. But targeting masses of the public, deleting specific memories all in one stride? It seemed particularly invasive and particularly difficult. Had Lydia known? We'd be shells, Lydia had said of the Overrider. Every memory, every part of your mind that makes you... you. Ripped out. Is that what she'd hinted at when they'd been escaping from the prison on Hool? Is that what Nero was attempting on the scientist she and Allie had seen on the Zeppelin? They were vacant. Childlike. Drawing triangles obsessively for no reason. Had they lost their minds to this experimentation? We'd be shells. And what would anyone want to erase on a mass scale? There were more facts and figures that Kara's mind skipped over until she got toward the final fragment. As the political divide is insurmountable with our current history. This provides the necessary justification for the memory of the Great War itself to be erased from the collective memory, for the good of the people and advancement of the galaxy. Kara, Pavel said, letting the translation drop, so the words rearranged into the original text. Do you recognize the language? She shook her head, half in response to Pavel, half in disbelief at what she'd read. Some sort of ancient collusion, I'm guessing.
Yes, it's no longer spoken or taught to the public, Pavel said. It's royal collusion. It's a language passed down only through the royal lineage and read only by the highest in the Ta'an cabinet.
Understanding dawned on her. Her skin started to prickle. What are you saying?
That this was written to the Emperor Ta'an himself.
Turn on the translator again. When the words arranged themselves into a language she could read, Kara scanned down to the bottom.
Executive Order 10642. Her father had signed his name right under it. Emperor Ta'an had not only known of the overrider technology, he'd planned to use it.
Chapter 4. Alyosha. The guards kept saying it was a camp, and no one was going to call them out on it. The prisoners wouldn't even talk about it with each other. It made sense, Ali guessed. Throughout the whole history of humankind, people had always been in a rush, taking shortcuts, dropping words, slurring phrases together. Good morning became morning, and don't worry about it became no worries, and what's going on became what goes. And so internment camp just became camp. It had been 2 days since Ali and Kara had been separated during the protests. 2 days since Ali had been taken in by the Uniforce, despite the fact that now Fruma was technically neutral. 2 days. But already it felt like an eternity. He had kicked and screamed and got the Tahis beat out of him. They were cowards, all of them, taking a cheap shot to the back of his head before he could even shout for Kara to keep going. Not knowing where she was drove him crazy now. All kinds of things could have happened to her. It was a war. Soldiers became monsters. And Rhiannon had put a target on Jocelyn's back, whether or not she'd meant to. It scared him to think how many people were looking around for Kara, and how many of them might try and get a higher price from Nero for delivering Jocelyn dead. And now, he wasn't there to protect her. It was all his fault. He hadn't followed his instincts to take her hand and hitch a ride the hell off this moon, to the edge of the galaxy. Just disappear. Take care of his. Being with Kara messed with his head like that, made him think that if they could get a person like her on the collusion throne, then all of them had a damn decent future ahead of them. A chance at peace. But that had been a pipe dream. A fantasy he'd been swept up in. And now he'd paid the price. They might have been rounding up only Raytons and Fontesians, but who knew what they'd do with a collusion girl aiding and abetting the enemy? And who knew what would happen if they found out that collusion girl was actually the Empress of Kalu? Ali knelt in front of a makeshift altar littered with statues of Vodhan in different sizes. Some people had brought them from their homes, a last-second grab before they were forced into the camps. And some of them were made here, carved out of a fine white talc that dissolved a little bit more every day. There wasn't a ceiling, meaning the dust floated in and coated everything. The walls were stained and grimy with handprints. The whole place overrun with rats longer and leaner than any he'd ever seen, because of the lower gravity. The air was thick with the scent of close, unwashed bodies. It was worse than the Ray, which was saying a whole lot. Initially, Ali wasn't praying at this makeshift altar so much as avoiding the chaos of the hangar's back lot. But he grabbed a loop of prayer beads tangled at the feet of the statues and held it in his hand, clutching one between his thumb and his knuckle as he said Vodhan's prayer. He'd said it 1,000 times before, mumbled it under his breath without much thought to the words, rushing through the calls and responses so the Fontesian missionaries would let him run out of the church tent and play. Even now, praying made him antsy. Like there was something else he should be doing. Scheming, strategizing, figuring out his next move. But in that quiet moment, as soon as he closed his eyes, the words came back to him. That prayer emerging from that dark, murky ocean, sloshing around in his skull. It had come to him, that wisp of a long-term organic memory, like it had traveled on a current all the way around the world to come back to him, to bring him home. He said the words. He prayed. Allie didn't know if he'd ever felt Vodhun's spirit more than he did in this moment. The hangar that housed the internment camp opened up to a fenced-in outdoor area, which was guarded by Uniforce soldiers standing at intervals all the way around. The Uniforce's peacekeeping unit hadn't split up the Fontizian and the Raetan prisoners. Why would they? Raeta and Fontis were technically on the same side, both actively anti-collusion and thus, according to the backward logic of Naufruma, a latent threat to the moon's sworn neutrality. Detaining them in the first place was an act of martial law, which seemed to mean Naufruma's security police could basically do whatever they wanted. It was a load of Tahis, not just because of the moon's true allegiance to Kalu, thinly disguised as neutrality, but because they were oblivious to the tensions between the Fontizians and Raetans. What else would anyone expect? It was Fontis that had colonized Raeta long before Kalu had blown his planet to bits. Fontis that scooped the Raetans up like a bully with someone else's toy, mined the entire surface for all the precious minerals that didn't exist anywhere else in the galaxy, brought in their precious god, Vodhun. And then what? They'd roped Raeta into wars they'd never wanted a part of. So many of his own would never forget that. Some hated Fontis almost as much as they hated Kalu. The guards would have had to be blind if they didn't see those tensions. Slurs like Vodhead and Dusty were thrown all across the camp. And it didn't matter to anyone working there. There was no skin off anyone's back if the two groups tore each other apart. But they'd separated themselves with an aisle down the middle of the lot, as wide as the Ismi River. Everyone treated it like snake-infested water. Cross it, and you'd be liable to get yourself killed. For the most part, Allie had been treated okay by the other prisoners. Tons of them recognized him from the holovision show The Revolutionary Boys, knew he'd been accused of killing Princess Rhiannon, and acquitted by default when she'd announced she was alive over Hollow. Which meant Allie was a big hero. Hugs, high fives, claps on the back as soon as anyone got close enough to touch him. He was a celebrity all over again, and he hated it. What had he done for any of them? Not a damn thing. Now he had to turn it on, smile like he did for the cameras, more people to impress and more shit to make up for. Besides, being charming was his best friend and co-star Vin's job. And now, having all these people who treated him like hot stuff just because he had the decency to not kill the princess seemed twisted. But they didn't know what he'd done. That his own petty nonsense had gotten Vin killed in the crash over Nidaz. That he'd broken out of a jail on Hool and left all the other prisoners behind. That way back when, he'd passed as collusion, abandoned his own history and his own people, just because it was easier if folks didn't consider him a Dusty. No, he didn't deserve to be famous. And he didn't want to be, either. It was the reason he'd been chosen to blame in the first place. He was easy to pick off then, and, he was worried, just as easy to pick off now. Allie thought a lot about whoever had framed him. Whose decision was it to point at this black guy's hollow image and say, him? Was it personal? And were they tracking him now? He couldn't shake the feeling that any minute he would get dragged away and accused all over again on yet another public forum. No way he'd been absolved for real. The paranoia made him look around now. Most of the inmates were obsessed with their handhelds, tech some of them had smuggled in. The guards looked the other way, because they were too lazy or didn't care, but usually the inmates at least pretended to hide them. Now, though, they weren't even bothering. Dozens of hollow screens shimmered throughout the room. Only then did Allie remember that today was the day Empress Rhiannon was supposed to return to Kalu. How could he have forgotten? The scene was somehow worse, replicated across so many different handhelds in the crowd. The Empress was there now on the hollow screen, petite yet regal, with a slight frown stretched across her brow. She was wearing the ceremonial red, and she was getting egged. Riots were spreading through the capital city of Cebu. Allie closed his eyes, felt the blood cement in his veins. For years, people had fawned over the girl, and when she was younger, they'd given her a half-assed name like Rose of the Galaxy, built her up as the orphan princess trapped in her desert tower, then turned on her in 30 seconds flat. Once she was partway to being a woman and not just some little girl, they made her a symbol they could point their fingers at, blame her for their terrible lives. His heart half broke for the girl, but it didn't surprise him. Not even a little bit. Allie knew better than anyone how the public listened to the first thing they heard if a guy like Nero said it. On screen, a glass bottle shattered at Rhiannon's feet, and someone, a Fontizian guard of all folks, grabbed her and threw her over his shoulder like she was no more than a kid. Which was pretty much true. She was only 16. And she was Kara's little sister. He still hadn't wrapped his head around it all. That he'd fallen for a Ta'an. The true Empress, though she seemed to hate thinking of it. She preferred he still call her Kara and not her real name, Jocelyn. And she'd liked him back. Not that they'd ever talked about it, on account of being on the run for their lives the whole time they'd been together. But he'd felt it in their kiss, in the heat of her touch, in the stubborn way she'd stuck with him when anyone else in the galaxy would have walked away for good. And now, with Rhiannon's return made official, Allie should be a free man, and he and Kara should have been safe. Nope. Almost as soon as he'd tasted freedom, it was yanked away from him once again. Here he still was, separated from Kara and Pavel. He'd told the little man to go find Kara, but he couldn't help but worry the droid had been relegated to some far-flung scrapyard. War was raging everywhere, even on the most protected, peace-loving moon in the galaxy. The mood in the camp was mixed. Some folks were shaking their heads, looking smug, like they'd seen it before and they'd seen it coming. Like Allie, most of the Raytons weren't surprised about the tahis of a reception the princess just got. Some of them were probably glad, too. The Ta'ans had technically saved their butts in the Great War by ending it, but only after making a mess of their entire planet. And in the process, they'd displaced Raytons, scattering them around the galaxy in Ray towns that were nearly as bad as this camp. Even now, the damage inflicted by the Great War made Allie's mind reel. Its legacy threaded itself into him, made it so the anger shaped his present and future. How could you undo something like that? Some of the Fontizians, however, especially the ones old enough to remember the Great War, didn't look all that smug about Rhiannon's wobbly reception. Probably because the writing was on the wall. Not even the Ta'ans could stabilize things now. Things were notching up toward a full-scale war, and pretty soon, Allie's gut told him, every single piece of rock in the galaxy would be tainted with the stink of death. Allie's cue buzzed suddenly, and he ripped his gaze from the hollow screen, scared, adrenaline coursing through him. They'd forced him to turn his cue back on once they imprisoned him in the camps. and forced a cube update that was about halfway complete. He could only think of one other update in the last few years. And there was a lot of lead-up, a big campaign to outline the perks, and a safety warning to update in the night since it took processing power and made you drowsy. No warning with this one, though. He didn't like it, one bit, but he had no choice. Now a cube notification was how they summoned the prisoners in waves, so they'd come to the fence for food or water or a shower, which was really just a hose on full blast that pushed through the chain-link fence. He hadn't showered yet. He was avoiding it as long as he could. He was no animal. When he looked around, no one else seemed to react, which could mean he was going to get his ass beat. No witnesses, or even worse, that whoever had framed him had found him. Allie trembled, nearly frozen until his cue buzzed again, this time stronger, like it would when he used to get priority calls from Uniforce headquarters. When he closed his eyes, he saw the designation Vestibule 17 flash across his eyelids. Running parallel to the fence, nearly flush with it, the vestibules were dark, rectangular boxes that felt like confessional booths. They provided privacy while your ass was getting kicked by a guard, and conveniently, being penned in by an electric chain-link fence was the quickest way to remind anyone you might as well be an animal to the Uniforce soldiers. It would get worse the longer he waited, so he slipped out of the crowd and made his way toward the meeting place. He'd been to a prison once before on Hool, but he knew what guards were like, guys who needed to feel big by treating you like tahis. Sometimes being compliant and chill wasn't enough. Sometimes you had to act like you were excited to be ordered around. You did what you had to because your life depended on it. Moonlight framed the soldier. He had a small build, compact, feet planted firmly on the ground. The guard didn't say anything, so Allie didn't either. Didn't matter how small he was. With a stunner in your hand, you didn't need to be bigger. You just needed to be heartless. The guard came closer, and Allie took half a step back. "It's me," a girl's voice whispered. "Kara." "How?" Allie moved forward, but she shook her head. In the distance, he saw another guard, a real guard, pause on his rounds. He needed to pretend he was still being bossed around by a guard, but he was nearly losing his mind with relief, happiness. But then he realized where they were and what she'd risked. "You shouldn't be here," he said. "You need to leave." "You're welcome for coming to save you?" He couldn't see her face in the dim moonlight, but he heard it in her voice. She was offended and hurt. "I'm not messing around," Allie said. He didn't have time to spare her feelings. Not now. Not when there was so much at stake. He lowered his voice and looked behind him quickly. "The place is crawling with Uniforce. You're too important to be running around the moon." "Couldn't agree more. That's why we're leaving. Pavel is waiting for us in the market." So the droid had found her. Fear gave way to relief. They'd been together, looked out for each other. Kara ducked further into the shadows and pulled back a patch of fence, squeezing through it to freedom. He glanced behind him. The guard had moved on. And this portion of the fence was protected from the robotic view of the daisies by the vestibules. He shimmied through the opening she'd cut, and together they ran in silence across the desert swells. 100 meters from the camp, he stopped her. He couldn't wait any longer, though they were still close enough to be visible to the guards, if someone on the tower happened to point a scope their way. He took her in his arms without a word. He could feel her body heat, feel the curve of her hip through the fatigues she wore. Their mouths were so close. This was all he'd thought about for days. His body took over. His hands moved up to cup her face, and his mouth found hers. It didn't matter that his lips were chapped, or that hers were. It wasn't like any kiss they'd had before. It was urgent, desperate, tinged by the war and the violence and every terrible thing that had come to pass in the weeks they'd known each other, all mixing with the hope in his chest that grew and grew until everything else was cast aside.
He kissed her so she'd know how grateful he was. She'd come back for him.
Allie tilted his head, and Kara pressed her hands against his cheeks, pulling him closer.
He held her tight, his hands moving up her back. His lips moved away from her mouth and to her cheeks, then brushed her ear before he dragged them down her neck and felt her shudder. His lips would go everywhere. He'd go anywhere if it meant this.
Was this love?
Chartois. Yes. Yes, it was love. He'd tell her now. He grabbed her face and kissed her again, but Kara pulled herself away, and he felt himself sucked down into the wake of her absence. Her face caught the moonlight. Their fingers were intertwined, palm to palm, and he realized he still had the prayer beads. He slipped the bracelet from his wrist to hers.
"Allie," she whispered, her eyes tracking up and down his face.
"Were you praying?"
"I prayed for you," he said.
She squeezed his hand. "We have to hurry."
Suddenly, he felt disoriented. Confused, too. He turned to look back at the camp, nestled between the giant dunes, casting light smear toward the stars.
"What about the rest of the prisoners?"
Kara hesitated.
"We can come back."
"How?" Allie took a step away from her.
"When?"
Then, behind them, a shout. Allie saw figures silhouetted against the floodlights, gesturing in his direction. More shouting. An alarm began to sound. Kara knew to move before he did. She pulled him back and he stumbled before he could get his feet working and break out into a run. There was a screaming in his ears.
No, a screaming in the air, in the sky.
It wasn't until way too late that he saw it. A third planetary body.
A moon?
He thought stupidly. It was bigger than even Kalu from where he stood. And it was getting bigger. Closer. Falling from the sky. Then it got so loud he couldn't hear himself think. The noise crowded out everything, the shape growing even larger as it hurtled toward the camp. Allie grabbed Kara's hand and double-timed it past the crest of the next dune. He dragged her over and brought her head to his chest, both of them squatting, bracing for an explosion. But though the asteroid, or whatever it was, must have hit, Allie felt nothing but a slight change in the air. A ripple. A vibration.
Kara pushed away from him.
What? Her words were swallowed by a massive halo of light exploding across the world. He brought his hand to his face to shield his eyes. He could almost call it pretty. The sky lit up with what looked like lightning. And there was a crash, like a million thunderbolts, a sound that seemed to ricochet toward them in slow motion. Allie felt his cube connection flicker, then cut out. The world went dark. Dark. And loud. Everyone, all at once, began to shout.
An M-bomb?
He said to himself. It was an enormous electromagnetic pulse that would fry everything operated by electricity. They'd been banned by a decades-old treaty, but for years there had been whispers of planets hoarding M-bombs, building them, trading them. Scare tactics, Allie had always thought.
Hoped.
But when he scrabbled to the top of the dune, he saw that it was true. From where he stood, it looked like a targeted attack. Portions of Naufruma still appeared to be unaffected, and lights twinkled from distant buildings. Uniforce wouldn't have disabled their own internment camp.
Could someone be staging a coup?
Kara staggered to her feet, reached out her hand, and found his. There was sand between their palms, in their fingernails.
We need to get on a craft while we still can.
Allie shook his head, looking out over the dune. A prisoner ran out of the hole Kara had cut in the fence, then another and another. More streamed out behind him. If the M-bomb had succeeded, he could only imagine the chaos inside.
We can't just leave them, he said.
An explosion went off. This time, louder. There was an orange light coming from above the camp. And he knew it was fire before he saw it. He could smell the smoke. Allie peeked over and saw people streaming out of the camp now, some of them clashing with guards as they fled. Allie, she tugged on his hand before he could move. All of this, everything that's happening now, it's all Nero's fault. I can't help if Uniforce gets me. Is that what you want to do? Help? His voice was unexpectedly loud. He couldn't help but think of Hul and all the people they'd left there. But he and Kara had had to escape because of Lydia, because she'd been dying. They'd had no time. What was his excuse now? All of a sudden, everything, the internment camp, the roundups, the M-bomb, the conflict on neutral territory, coalesced into a burning pit of anger deep inside him, pulsating so hard he was afraid that he might explode, just like that bomb. All of this was the fault of those in power, using the rest of the galaxy as their pawns, like the universe was their playground to wage war as they pleased. Allie was sick of it, sick of royals and rulers making the wrong choices. Because if you wanted to help, you could stop running, announce yourself, you could take the throne. As soon as he had spit out the words, he was surprised, but more convinced than ever it was true. Maybe Kara could change things, change the world. You have to try, right? It was a solid plan. Better than taking off on some wild quest to find the Overrider just 'cause you think Lydia wanted you to. And then what, Allie? Kara's voice rose sharply. I don't know the first thing about ruling. You'd figure it out, Kara. He put his palm to her cheek. He'd memorized every feature, every expression. But Kara's face was different now. It was so slight, he might not have noticed. But the time apart made it clear, and it made him feel disoriented, dizzy, like the ground was shifting under him. You don't need the Overrider to be able to help other people. You do that just fine on your own. I need the Overrider because it's dangerous. Lydia said as much. She practically told me to destroy it, for a reason. She wrenched away from him. Worry notched up his throat. You don't even know the half of it, what it can do. We might be the only people who know it really exists. I'm not coming with you to watch you get killed, Allie said. I think you're scared of ruling. So that's what you're concerned with all of a sudden? Putting me on the throne? Kara spat out, those eyes swirling with color out of control. You just want to give up on finding the Overrider? I'm not giving up. Look around you. The galaxy is at war. Allie knew better, but he couldn't stop. Look, how about we go straight to the capital, find your sister, tell her who you are, make a game plan for finding the Overrider once we're safe. Or maybe they'll accuse me of being an imposter and stun me on sight. Kara's voice had risen to a shout. People have made decisions for me my whole life. Lydia decided that she'd wipe my memory for my safety. You're telling me I should leave you here for my safety. She'd said the last part like she was bitter, scorn smeared all over her face. But other people's decisions are the reason I'm here. When do I get to choose? Allie's jaw clenched. And what would you choose, Kara? You want to live a lie, pretend you're someone else, run off to be a hermit in Lurrus while the world around you burns? She actually gasped. Kara had told him once that the beach in Lurrus was her happy place, and he'd thought it was so sweet and optimistic. At the time, he had wanted to fold up the idea and put it in a pocket over his heart. And now, here he was, throwing it in her face. Tahis, Kara, I didn't mean anything by it. He trailed off. I know all there is about living a lie, pretending you're someone else because it's easier, because being you is scary, or because it scares everyone else. He thought of passing for collusion, and how hard it was, and how it never ended up being worth it. What I'm trying to say is, if you don't want to live a lie, it's up to you to change the truth. He couldn't read her face, but he thought maybe he'd gotten through to her. Or at least she wouldn't be super pissed at him. Kara? He said at the same exact moment a huge thunderclap struck. It was crazy loud, deafening. His voice, the sound of her name on his tongue, dissolved in the noise. The gates of the hangar exploded, and people came gushing from all directions as if everyone had woken up from a bad dream at the same time, and the anguished cry had woken with them. Through the rise of bright dust, the detainees were all breaking out now, streaming down the hill like a burst volcano. He made brief eye contact with another Raton woman and saw the fear in her eyes. "What's happening?" She grabbed him and squeezed, like a vice closing around his forearm. Allie felt her anger melting into fear. Her knuckles turned white. He didn't know. He didn't know anything but a truth born of long experience. When people ran, there was usually good reason to follow their lead. The crowd surged and then pummeled them forward with it. They barreled over the dunes, past the scrap heap at the edges of the city, funneling into the chaos of streets half dark and wiped of network. In the distance, through the dust-filled air, he thought he saw the summer palace. Here the crowd was thickening, crushing. They reached a shuttered shop, and Allie hoisted Kara up toward the roof, suddenly afraid of a stampede, of being threshed beneath all those stumbling bodies. The shouting and screaming was getting louder. Kara made it onto the roof. He was about to follow. Then, another flash of light. Brighter than the first. Impossible. The ground pulsed once, and an invisible force threw them sky high. Allie tried to grab Kara's hand, but there was nothing except air. He was blind and deaf, suspended, until he crashed to the ground and felt pain like a single note playing again and again through his body. Then, abruptly, it fell silent, and Allie fell into the dark. Chapter 5. Rhiannon. "Tahis," Rhi murmured for the 100th time as she exited her quarters. She should have seen it coming. It was classic Nero, she realized. Capitalizing fast, within 24 hours of her return home, and using Rhi's homecoming as a deflection, to distract the rest of the galaxy from what was happening on Nau Fruma. Ty Rayana stood at the center of the antechamber, her body tense as she pressed her finger to her cube. Rhi felt anxious on multiple levels. She was too scared to turn her cube on, but frustrated having to rely on everyone else for up-to-date information. Even Ty Rayana using her cube put Rhi on edge, but her caretaker had refused to power down. The Ty's stiff, formal white robes folded around her like thick swaths of snow. On the hollow before them, the news was projected. The Uniforce and the Raton-Fontizian Coalition, a vigilante army, were engaged in combat on the neutral moon of Nau Fruma. And it was all because of Nero. He'd done the unthinkable. While she was supposedly dead, he'd rounded up Raytons and Fontizians on Nau Fruma soil and interned them illegally using Uniforce soldiers. The WFC had run a rescue mission to free the detainees, claiming the camp was a violation of Nau Fruma's neutrality. They dropped an M-bomb to break open the camp's gates and render anything using electricity useless, even cubes. In retaliation, Uniforce dropped a real bomb. Now the two armies were going head-to-head, and the ground combat on Nau Fruma had already claimed too many casualties on either side. The rest of the galaxy was in a panic. If neutrality couldn't be respected, nowhere was safe. And everything had been documented on the Hollows, except that drone vision had never covered the internment on Nau Fruma in the first place. Funny how Nero had made sure that the subsequent attack by the WFC was getting plenty of airtime. "Have you gotten through?" Rhi asked. She sat down on an ornate chair and then stood up immediately. Her throat was dry, and she couldn't stay still. Her tie glanced sideways, giving a small, irritated shake of her head. It was worrisome that no one had briefed Rhi. Ty Rayana couldn't get through to the Uniforce commander on Nau Fruma. "Their comms must still be out as a result of the M-bomb," Ty Rayana offered unhelpfully. "And the most recent update
might have slowed down communications.
But even as she said it, the tie didn't sound at all convinced. They didn't need to speak the most likely truth. Nero had Uniforce's loyalty. The one stationed here in the capital had barely lifted a finger to protect Rhee when the riots broke out upon her arrival. And Rhee wouldn't dare reach out to any of them now. In spite of the war in her territories and the fact that so far Jocelyn hadn't come forward, Rhee didn't know whether this was a good or a bad sign. Rhee's thoughts kept returning to Julian. Was he still on Nowfruma? And was he okay? Did he know she'd killed Vayron? And would he die thinking she had betrayed him? She couldn't tear her eyes away from the screen. Rhee was already running through the various scenarios in her head. The Order would assist, surely. Maybe that's what Nero wanted, to push her closer to Fontis, paint her as out of touch, a traitor. But she couldn't think about that when people were dying. She'd release a broadcast to the Collusion territories, too, urging them to organize, to gather supplies. Any medical staff in proximity would need to make themselves available to travel to the moon. Perhaps she could go herself. If we can't get through to Uniforce, we need to send help.
Help, Anuk?
The Tai asked. She fell into a chair. Her headscarf came loose, and graying black hair escaped from her temple. Rhee used to resent the term. It meant child, and when she'd heard it, she would revert back to the child she was at six. A lonely orphan, a brat, a girl unworthy of her name. But now it reminded Rhee of her family, and tied her closer to the tie.
We need help, Rhiannon, she sighed. We're at the mercy of a madman.
I'm not at anyone's mercy, Rhee insisted as she began to pace the length of a tasseled rug. She'd refused all of Nero's attempts to contact her. There'd been a deluge of comms. And if I want to establish peace, establish trust, I'll need to neutralize the threat on Nowfruma.
How will you neutralize a neutral moon? More armed forces will only mean greater tensions, more violence, and air travel has been restricted.
Then I will unrestrict it! Rhee's voice crested to a shout. She felt the anger dissolving everything inside and out.
That place was our home. For years, the people on that moon, they were family.
Do not lecture me about family.
The Tai looked at her with a depth in her eyes that rooted Rhee to the floor.
And think twice before you choose to yell at me.
Rhee bowed her head. Tyreana, she trailed off, unsure how to structure an apology when she had so much to be sorry for. Her outburst wasn't just embarrassing. It was unfit for an empress. I dishonor myself. I take your mentorship for granted. Tyreana took Rhee's hands in her own.
I know you're worried about the people on Nowfruma, about Julian.
But we're not yet certain if he can be trusted. It was a conversation they'd danced around before. Tyreana hadn't approved of Rhee reaching out to Julian in the first place. She hadn't said why, and she didn't have to. Rhee had considered and refused the possibility that Julian had been working with his father all along, that he might have been a traitor too. Heat flushed through Rhee. She shook her head.
It's not just about him. The Nowfrumans need to know that I'm going to protect them.
On the hollows, another explosion shook Nowfruma, and the tiny sliver of calm she'd found slipped away. There, on the projected image, was the violence Nero's hand had reaped. Did he enjoy his cruelty? Did he take pleasure in treating lives as if they were expendable? Rhee slipped her hands out of her ties, trying to silence the panic that was making her ears burn and her head spin.
Does Dallan know?
She'd have to find him in this enormous palace. He'd gone off with the fishermen to scout the property and discuss security detail, his favorite subject as of late. It had been a shock to find that all the servants who'd worked for her family and stayed through Regent Siotra's reign had abandoned the palace. Either they'd been scared off or paid,
maybe lured by Nero's promises. But it was a slap in the face, and a further reminder that the Rose of the Galaxy wasn't as precious as she'd once been. Rhee hastily shoved one foot in her boot, and then the other. I'm going to find Dalin. They'd need a plan. She wouldn't sit here, moping, feeling sorry for herself. Rhee raced through the palace as Tai Rihanna called after her. The familiar twists and turns, the feel of the elaborate woven rug underneath her. Even the smell reminded her of her childhood. But instead of the bustling energy, the warmth, the interplanetary dignitaries that had filled it with music and company, there was only an eerie silence throughout the halls. In it, an organic memory rose up, and Rhee heard Joss's voice taunting her with its echo. Come and find me, Joss had called once when Rhee went to chase her. So many years she'd spent chasing the sister who wanted nothing to do with her, who called her a baby, taunted her. Even now her sister's voice flooded Rhee from every direction, driving her mad. She was inept. She'd never be enough. She'd never find her. She couldn't keep up with Joss then, and she couldn't keep up with Nero now. She hadn't been raised to rule. She wasn't meant for it. That was Jocelyn's role. But the very person Rhee needed most in the world, the one she'd publicly begged to come home, hadn't appeared. Was she lost or in danger? Or was it the case that Joss didn't want to come forward? Maybe she was smart enough to know what Rhee was only now just learning. Being Empress was thankless, hopeless, and it was best to quit before you even started. It was such a cowardly thing to think of her sister and of her role as Empress. She dishonored her father's legacy, and Rhee felt the shame burn its way through the surface of her skin, mar her face, her features, so that she would wear it for everyone to see. Maybe everyone saw it already. When the hallway forked, she made a right, prompting a voice behind her to tisk. It was close. Too close. Rhee spun around, startled, kicking the arc of a roundhouse, but a Fontisian girl slipped backward, just out of Rhee's reach. Rhee recognized her at once. She had been standing on the steps when Rhee arrived, the one with the yellow and orange eyes. Now she was wearing a dark tunic that squared at her shoulders, like many others of the Fontisian order did. Her blonde braid was now coiled in a bun. Who are you? Why are you following me? Rhee fired out questions quickly to conceal her embarrassment. The girl was part of the guard that Dalin oversaw. I didn't mean to startle you. She wore her bow and arrow strapped to her back. Her ears were slightly pointed, like Dalin's. I'm Lana. Rhee straightened up, smoothing her dress, trying to preserve some semblance of dignity. You're one of the archers? The girl raised her eyebrows, so light they were nearly white. She gestured to the bow behind her. Does it not appear so? The gesture felt familiar. Then Rhee remembered she had seen Lana on Arroway, too. She had been sparring in the courtyard when Rhee had met with the Fontisian elder, Eskov. He'd revealed that Jocelyn was still alive, that the Order had helped hide her, so thoroughly that even they didn't know where Joss had gone. Where's Dalin? We'll have to arrange for aid to Nau Fruma. There's been... A bombing, I know. The girl pivoted on her heel and began to walk away. I'm not to delay. If it was an invitation, it was hardly a compelling one. Still, Rhee followed. Where are we going? She asked, quickly falling into step with the girl. Of course Dalin already knew. He always knew.
There are things he knows, and things he doesn't know he knows.
It's what Elder Eskov had told Rhee on Arroway, that Dalin had some critical piece of information and kept it hidden, deep within, even from himself. The Northwing study, which Dalin has turned into a strategy room, he's arranging for aid to the moon. He set up a briefing as soon as we heard of the bombings. she said, her eyes panning left and right as they walked briskly down the hall.
Good,
Rhi said. Dalin understood her. Movement, action, strategy. But something irked her, tugged at the edge of her nerves.
And how long ago did the Situation Room and Dalin's strategy come together?
I can't decipher your real question, Empress. Please oblige me and ask it outright.
Aren't you the same kind of charming as Dalin? Rhi shot back. Which is to say, not at all.
She immediately regretted firing back, if only because she wore her embarrassment on her sleeve.
Lana smiled, as if satisfied with Rhi's reaction. Ancestors. Who cared what this girl thought? It was true there was a deeper veiled question. She'd become Empress to take control of her destiny, and that of her planet. And yet, since the very second she'd stepped into the role, things were constantly done for her, without her input. She was as powerless as she'd always been.
What I meant to ask, Rhi stated evenly in her best diplomat's voice, is if Dalin sent for me. If he'd intended to consult me at all.
Lana stopped abruptly and cocked her head. Her eyes narrowed, and the left side of her mouth tilted the tiniest bit higher.
Don't you smell roses? She asked.
Rhi was irked by the girl's misdirection.
What?
Roses,
Lana repeated, frowning. She obviously wasn't going to let it drop. Rhi looked around and realized they were passing through the east wing.
My mom's garden. It's right outside. You can see it from this window.
She crossed the threshold into a guest room. A breeze fluttered the curtains, cool despite the season. It would rain soon, and Rhi loved the hot thunderstorms of her childhood. She moved toward the window, but Lana grabbed her forearm and yanked her down to her knees. For a second, Rhi's breath caught. They were so close she could make out the fringe of Lana's eyelashes, see the soft lines of her mouth. She pulled away forcefully.
Are you out of your mind?
But before she could stand, an arrow sailed through the window, cleaving the air directly where Rhiannon had stood, even as Lana shoved her roughly backward. She came up against the wall and gasped.
How did you know?
The window should have been kept closed,
Lana answered, curtly. Three more arrows whistled as they cut through the air, and Lana unsheathed a sword with a speed Rhi had never seen. It was a blur, the metal reflecting light for a split second as she whipped the blade through each one in turn. She dropped to her knees again and rolled right up against the wall beneath the window, shoulder to shoulder with Rhi. More arrows soared through. A dozen, two dozen. White ribbons attached to the shafts looked almost beautiful as they whipped and trailed. Rhi could barely think over the noise of the arrows piercing the walls and the furniture. A blizzard of feathers spilled from the pillows. The air shimmered with cotton fluff and sawdust. The girls sat side by side, staring. And then, suddenly, it was quiet. The arrows had stopped. And in the vacuum, Rhi could hear her own heartbeat. She let out a shallow breath. Then, there was the drumming of footsteps down the hall. Then Dalin's voice moving from the hallways of the great palace and further away. She could tell he was outside now as he and his guards combed the gardens. The smell of roses only intensified. They were slicing through her mother's bushes with their blades, hacking through the growth. Rhi willed herself not to cry. The room was suddenly full of her guard. Guards pulling her to her feet, guards asking her if she was all right, guards muttering and speaking in code. The fisherman carefully shouldered his way into the room. His blue skin had turned a shade of purple, as if he'd flushed with anger, and the features crowded along the bottom of his face looked puckered and angry. An unlikely ally who hailed from the outer belt, he'd helped Rhi disguise herself as a marked child on Tanopa by attaching the octoersis to her face. He had also saved her life, and Dalin's, by ripping the ceiling off of the facility on Hul with a harpoon gun and ushering them to safety.
Who left the window open? Dalin's shout rose up from out below them.
The fisherman gave the room a sweeping look of disdain. 100 ribbons shuddered on the 100 arrows embedded in the door.
A soon-to-be-dead man,
the fisherman said.
I'll weed out the traitor.
His eyes met Rhys for a moment, and he nodded just before he exited, saying nothing further. Rhys moved away from her guards and bent to pull the ribbon off a nearby shaft.